involving science and the Christian worldview of nature, the relationship between science and the logical connection between science and Christian faith, biblical theism. Okay, we come now to page 4 of our syllabus, and we're getting to the history of science. This course is titled, in case you've forgotten, History and Logic of Science. And we study both together. Come now to the history of science, and we begin somewhat arbitrarily with the 17th century, 1600, the birth of modern science. And, thank goodness today. The birth of modern science. And beginning with the 1600s, the 17th century, we see what I call crucial and rapid change, a whole different way. Western civilization begins to be Western civilization, as we know it, and a man begins to look at the world, the universe, himself, the relationship between himself and the universe, a whole different way. What we're going to see is sort of get to speak to you of it in broad outline. What we see is man is a move from a theological world or a theological way of viewing things, from a position where Western man viewed everything theologically, to a position where he views everything materialistically. Someone who goes too far, obviously, but there's this shift, a theological way of looking at things with nature, and thus perhaps science, to a materialistic way. The two landmarks are, as far as what is written, is Galileo's Dialogues and Newton's Principia. Now, you see the dates there? This is why we go back to the 17th century. These two books were landmarks. They were transitional. Well, we discuss now the medieval view of nature. The medieval view of nature. What were the methods in science? Well, the background of the medieval method of science, if you want to call it that, was Greek. It was classical. 13th century. We see the beginnings of modern science in the recovery of ancient Greek science, the recovery of Greek science. Do you recall that that Western civilization from the classical period, where you had which was a city-based civilization, urban, with the fall of Rome, they're set in the Dark Age, where there was a rural-based civilization. Feudal society was the high point of this. And then the 16th century began to move back into a city-centered civilization and more learning. And in some way, to some extent at least, the Renaissance, we call it, this rebirth, that was a phrase coined by an 18th century scholar named Burckhardt. But it was a recovery of the literature of the classical period. It's not so much that the literature was discovered as if it had been lost. Matter of fact, it had not been lost. Most of our manuscripts today of Cicero and Plato and the others are medieval manuscripts. Almost all of them. They all are, really. They're all medieval manuscripts. So they had them. But they didn't read them. And one of the reasons they didn't, and those who did read them didn't make much of them. Why? Because they were pagan. And what part does paganism have to play in Christendom? And this was Christendom. And secondly, they could not relate to them. They were of a different world. They were almost like science fiction. That is, the literature of the classical age was of a city-centered, highly advanced civilization. And the people in the Middle Ages simply were not living in that kind of world. Therefore, they did not relate to them. They did not. So they rediscovered them in the sense that with the success of the feudal system and the rise of nations, that is the economic success, the rise of nations, the discovery of the New World. Marco Polo went east, and Magellan, Columbus, the rest of them, Pizarro went west. They opened up the New World. So as they began to open the New World, then the literature began to make more sense. They began to, they could relate to it, to use a cliche. It was a rediscovery in the sense of a new appreciation for it. And because of the failure of medieval Roman Catholicism, men were not thinking men, were no longer willing to simply dismiss the writings of Aristotle, for example, because he was a pagan. Or the Greek physical philosopher, or Pythagoras. Got that? They were willing to give new attention to these pagan writers, or the intellectual leaders of the old classical paganism. And so they began to look at them again. And as we know, the science, if you want to call it that, the cosmology, the view of the world and man, question of the world, in the media came to be in the late medieval period, the view of Aristotle. Thomas Aquinas synthesized, as I put there in the syllabus, you know what synthesized means. He synthesized medieval theology and Aristotelian cosmology so that when Galileo and Copernicus contradicted Aristotle, they were put on trial, they were accused of heresy because they were contradicting God. They weren't contradicting God at all. They were contradicting Aristotle. But Aristotle, because of Thomas Aquinas, Aristotelian science had been incorporated into Christian theology, and it was considered of God. You got that? So we have Aristotelian theology came in this way. What were they concerned about? The form or essence, misspelled, of an object. The purpose or potentiality of nature. That is strict. Still, this is theology. This is a very stern teleology. You all know what that is now, don't you? That is, they looked at the world, they wanted to know what was the nature of something and how did it fit into the plan of God. What was its purpose for here? Because still in this age, this world existed for the next. Earth is but the threshold of heaven. This world does not really count except as an antecedent to eternity. Therefore, there was a desire to discover the nature of things so that we could understand why these things existed and how they fit into God's purpose, which is very different from today, is it not? That is, things that they were not, even at the beginnings of the, what we call modern science, they were not interested in things for themselves. There was no interest in simply examining something just to see what it was like, how it was constituted, how it functioned, how it related with other objects. No, that was too. There was no interest in things as themselves. And here's an example of, so the background is Aristotle and the gradual recovery of Aristotle. The concern was purpose, potentiality, teleology, theology. Are you all following this? This is a little more difficult than what I teach. This is a part of my experience. The kind of explanations they came out with, very Aristotelian, the natural essence and purpose of objects. And he tried to examine objects to see their natural essence, what their character or nature is, and how they fit it in. And here's an example of causes. Medieval science broke causes down into final causes and formal causes. Final, that is, a formal cause is how it acts when you observe it. Its final cause is what is the ultimate purpose, which possibly will not be seen now, but will be seen in the future. Why does a stone exist? In other words, you drop it to see how heavy, you weigh it to see how heavy it is, and you throw it to see how far it'll go. You do all kinds of things to it, but the ultimate final, final causes, what was its ultimate purpose? There was no concern for efficient causes as simple cause and effect. Got that? Let me give you an example. I'm do this live. Let me teach you, so it's not yourself, so be in the revised syllabus. So you understand this. Here was Aristotle. Aristotle's four levels of cause. I put this on the board so you'll understand the syllabus better here. Four levels of cause. Now, I'm going to illustrate it this way. One, two, three, four. Yeah, that's so far. This is medieval, again, medieval science. There is the material cause, which would be the stone itself, a stone. Then there was the efficient cause, this is where a sculptor would perform the act of carving. There is the formal cause, the formal cause is the pattern followed by the carver. And then there was the final cause, the purpose for the work of art. Why did was it carved? Y'all see that? He used a sculptor as a model. You got that? The material cause is the stone. The efficient cause is the act of carving. That's why. But you look at a statue. You look at a statue, a big statue, and you see, somebody says, what is it and why is it here? Well, you say, you can break it down. You can say, well, the material cause for it being here is the stone itself. The efficient cause is the act of carving. The formal cause is the pattern that the artist had in mind, thus you get a man or a horse or whatever it is. But the final cause is his reason for doing it. Why did he carve it? Art for art's sake, or for whatever reason, to glorify a hero, to make money, whatever. Right. They're the final cause. Now, you understand that? So, the medieval science was concerned with final and formal causes only, not efficient causes and not material causes. Does that help you understand it? That is, they were not interested in the stone itself. Or the act. They assumed creation. They didn't want to know how a certain biological form got there. They just assumed God created it. Creation was assumed. Never questioned. And apply this as synthesis to Christian theology and Aristotelian cosmology. They were only concerned with the formal cause and the final. What is the pattern called? What is the essence of it? What's it supposed to be and what is its purpose? Well, you can see, thinking this way, much of modern science exists up here, does it not? The first two. The nature of the stone and the act of carving. The nature of the biological form. The nature of the dog and how it got here. Where did it come from? Is this making sense to you? I'm trying to realize it's not easy. So that, I think when I revise the syllabus, I'll put this in because helps us understand the difference in this, in the final and formal cause as opposed to the efficient cause. The focus was on the final end, not on moment-to-moment change. The behavior of a creature, it was assumed, follows from its essential nature. That is, they didn't, medieval science, I'm going to call it that, was not concerned with examining the flight of birds or the morals of a man. Why? He did what nature? Why? A modern scientist would go to a great extent to find out how a monarch butterfly migrates to Central America, and how it navigates. Does it follow the sun? Does it follow the magnetic pattern of the earth? How's it getting there? How long does it take? But the medieval science, the medieval thought, if you call it science, would just dismiss that. That's the nature of the mind. Things do what they're created to do. I see the butterflies migrate, man sins, dogs bark. That's the nature of things. You got that? So there was no science. There was no in the sense of investigating. That was the categorical answer. Now, we're not demeaning this unnecessarily. That's basically true. I mean, that's a certain amount of intelligence involved in that. That's the way they act. Why do they do it? The central feature of change was not anything like evolution, or the central feature of change was not what was involved when water became ice, for instance, but the transformation from potentiality to actuality. That is, logical connections, not simply temporal connections. That is, achieving their God-ordained purpose. Well, what were the cosmological, and you stop me if you don't understand this. What were the cosmological assumptions underlying this early method? Well, the cosmic hierarchy, by that I mean plants, the hierarchy, the rocks, above that, the plants, above that, the animals, above that, man, above that, the angels, above that, God, the Trinity. The hierarchy, the cosmic hierarchy, is assumed. And it got more sophisticated than that. That's the basic. And this hierarchy was the creation of a purposeful God. And therefore, the universe was assumed to be rational. That is, now listen to me, here we're sitting on solid ground, are we not? Because the cosmos, this hierarchy, which is a hierarchy, was the creation of a God who created for a purpose. Therefore, we live in a rational world. As opposed to a non-rational world, we are, as opposed to pure chance, as opposed to chaos, as opposed to insanity, the world, it makes sense. Now, they would not presume to know, to be able to discover the rational thing, the reason for everything. But the reason was there. You just don't know how it fits in. And by the way, that's the view I take. The rational world. And everything fits into the ultimate plan of God in some way. Much of it we can easily see, much of it we cannot see, but that doesn't the fact that we cannot see how every form fits into the total plan of God. That doesn't mean it doesn't fit in. It's a comment on our ignorance, our lack of information, our weakness. Now, some point every purpose was not necessarily discernible. How did they arrive at this? Deduction as opposed to induction. That is, thinking about it as opposed to examining it. Simple deduction. They didn't get this in the laboratory. They got it from the pulpit at the work, in the classroom. That is, it's simple deduction just makes sense. That is, they say, take a garden vegetable. They would assume the garden vegetable, its very nature was food, and it fit into the total purpose of God to sustain man. And how'd they arrive at that? By thinking about it, by drawing logical deductions. They didn't get it by putting the garden vegetable, putting a carrot under the microscope they didn't have, and examining it. This is not botany, this is not horticulture, this is theology, this is philosophers of deduction. And now listen, again, don't misunderstand that. It doesn't mean they're wrong. Not that you're right about it, isn't it, most likely? But talking about the method. You see, you can arrive at the truth with a number of methods. And deduction is a very good method. Now they did, but it was based on observation, not science. For instance, they were wrong about all things. For instance, what causes diseases? And the germ theory was not yet available. So they know that they had rats, they didn't have disease, yes, but they know why. Why? Because you see, they would go off on very wrong deductions. For instance, they believe that somehow the air was causing it. So what do? You shut out the air. And the smell is causing it. So what do? You cover up the smell and burn incense. Well, it didn't help very much. They were just working on deductions. It's not to pop into my mind. I watched a good bit of the Ten Commandments. It was hilarious. It's pretty, as far as the Bible's concerned, it's pretty accurate. Charlton Heston's theology, when it comes down from Mount Sinai, it's pure Christian science, but it bothered me. But anyway, I had trouble taking it seriously. Somebody really read it for it. I'm watching along, and here's the 10 plagues or visits on Egypt. Here's the Pharaoh who over him. He's hardened his heart. It had several of the plagues, and the return of blood and the lice and the dogs and the disease, the plague, everybody's dying. And he's telling Moses that it didn't really happen. It had natural causes. It didn't happen from God. And this was just before the last plague, which was the first one. And he said, well, I heard about you, but I'm coming. A plant got into the Nile up north and caused it to turn red and killed the frog. He said, naturally, the flies would be drawn to the carrion and spread the disease. It was a natural cause. Now, that's somebody writing after the year 1850, right in the year 1800. Somebody, two of their advisors, were going to pick up on that, because that's one thing Pharaoh never said. The idea, that's a very modern concept, that the flies would spread the disease. That would never have occurred to them. In fact, it's hilarious. It's like, that's what a modern doctor would say. And what they did, they were trying to make the liberals happy. That's what the liberals say. It's the older liberals, old classical liberalism, were pretty low when they wrote that script. So they were trying to fold in the sock. So they wrote that in, but it made it hilarious, because I like to call it the cat's laughing, because that's just like you just turn like the clock, and you have all of a sudden a Pharaoh and 2,000 or 1,400 years before Christ, spouting at least late 18th century medicine and science. Anybody with me? The idea they would never look at things and deduce the idea that a certain medieval man like ancient Pharaoh would never look at flies and carrion and make a connection between that and the disease. It's not obvious. So they were wrong about that. Y'all get my point? So that's called an anachronism. One of the worst anachronisms I've ever seen. The first time I saw yours, I was like, I was a jerk when you said it, because it was like, it would have been exactly the same as if he had said, well, that settles that, and he went back to a Corvette and drove off. the fuel exhaust on his chariot or something. Anyway. Do you see what I'm saying? So there are limitations of deduction. So sometimes they were very wrong about a lot of things, but they were right about a lot of things too. The wrong or right, this was the method, deduction. The primary question is, how does X fit into the overall scheme of things? The secondary matters were description, prediction, and control. Aristotle had done some biological classification, but the Platonic cosmology prevailed. That is, the nature of things, how they reflect the abstract ideal. Well, the teleological approach did not refer, does not require the creation of theories and testing of those theories by experimentation. That's a very important summary statement. You got that? The teleological approach did not require the creation of theories, the testing of theories by experimentation. That is, once you determine the purpose, then that's all that's really important. It doesn't matter how it acts, as long as you know why it acts. You know why it does a certain action, why a plant does a certain thing, or an animal acts in a certain way, or man does a certain thing. Then, as far as the how, you just dismiss it and say, well, that's the nature of the thing. God created it that way. No science in the modern sense. Any questions on that?
Yes. His concern with change, like handling temperature, wood is not as important as when the house gets warm.
Yeah. And also, well, handling temperature would not be important. The important thing is God created wood so we could have fire to warm ourselves and created it for man. And man is to glorify God for that and their blessings from heaven. It's here for the good of man, for which man must be grateful. Once you said that, that's also important. The theological world. It's all there. Now, this way of thinking is, we would not say that was all wrong. We could simply say it's all short, it's not too soon. In some cases, it could be wrong, but I'm saying the method itself doesn't force it to be wrong. It's just more limited than your own use. It's like this. You'll find this dual approach, even in the local ministry. This is not ancient history. For instance, if you try to do the local church systematic exegesis, no matter how carefully you try it, although there will be some people who will appreciate it, you'll have others who will dismiss it and put you down for it, because they'll say, well, we don't need to know all that. As long as man says his prayers and pays his tithe and lives the Christian life, why put the effort of learning? All of a sudden, you don't have to know. You see, the people may still have that, but you still have that dualism, that antagonism, as you call it. So, and we would say it falls too short, but the answer to that is that which we learn becomes part of what we are. Contributes to what we do. There is a reason for it. But many will not see that. My point is, they're very impatient with it. We have students, one of our better missionaries who had climbed my frame recently, because the Bible college here, she found out I teach, but had very little respect for theology. Well, you don't need to teach theology. But many would say, no, she didn't say yes, but others would say, or I heard her say, well, you don't need to teach Greek and Hebrew. Why? We've got a good English Bible. Why teach theology and all that other stuff, psychology? Why teach all that stuff? Epistemology of science. Just teach them the Bible. It's all we need. You say, let's get on with it. Well, would you deny the motive of that? No, I think the motive is good. We would simply say that we don't have that. That's just too limited. It's too not wrong in and of itself, except that unless it illegitimately limits man. So, that kind of thinking is still around, and we want to be careful and not dismiss it summarily, but not be limited by it.
At one time, that was a good thought, right? Well, just these might have told me, but now, everything going around, you have to know.
Oh, well, no, I don't think it was ever. I think it's one of the reasons that the medieval church came in today, because men became narrow. No, you see, I work on the proposition that all truth is God's truth. And that man is the image of God, and therefore man must know as much as possible. The more man knows of the truth. Now see, as you know, I've said a number of times, a lot of people think they're educated because they study a lot of things that aren't true. You learned a whole lot of what's not so. You don't have an education, you may have a degree, you just want to have an education. But as far as the truth is concerned, man can never know enough of the truth. All of the truth. And to the extent that he learns the truth about all things, about his world, about revelation, about himself, then to that extent does he fulfill his potential as one being in the image of God. So in that sense, I would not say that. Now what you're saying, you're right. You're saying that now the preacher has to face more issues than he had faced in times past. That's very true. For instance, if you look at the curriculum of the Bible College, the Cole College of the Bible back in 1919 and 1920, a lot of Shakespeare, a lot more languages, didn't have counseling, didn't have psychology, didn't very much, and didn't have a course like this, except in a very general way, didn't have a lot of education methods. Didn't read this Shakespeare. So there's a different kind of world. So in that sense, that's what you're going to be getting at. It's true, but I'd say ultimately no, the reason I gave it. Good question. Okay, any other questions or comments? When you see the kind of thinking that was the medieval world was dominated by teleological thinking, How about the cosmology of the medieval view of nature? Well, the earth was the fixed center of the universe, surrounded by concentric spheres. That's what Aristotle said. Now, you got that? The earth was the fixed center of the universe, and then there were concentric spheres, and the planets, and nearby were the moon, then there was the sun, then there were the stars. The earth was the center of the universe. Why? Now, note that was a theological deduction. Why? Why is the earth here? For man. Man is the center of God's creation, therefore, the earth is the center of the universe. Makes sense, doesn't it? It makes sense. Good deduction. The premises are false. But if the premises had been true, the conclusion would have been true. The premises had been true. Good deduction. But, now, it's hard. You got to look at things, and when you look up, interpret what you see to mean that here we are, and we're sitting still, everything's moving around. Right? But we don't seem to be moving. You know how fast are we moving? Several million miles an hour through space, the whole thing. Plus we're going this way. Plus we're going this way. There's a whole solar system. And the earth is going around the sun, and the earth is revolving on its axis. So there's motion three different ways. Yeah. One of them keep our balance. You understand that? There was whole systems moving. The earth is moving this way, and it's spinning. It's axis. Now, but you can't see that. You know, here you sit, what happened? Here we sit, and here comes the sun, and that comes up in the east. What's the moon do? The moon rises and falls. And we look at the stars, and they shift. As the year goes by, a certain time of the year, this constellation will be here, and it will move around, and another will come up, and then pretty soon, next year. Then we're out, then have the constellation again, just where it was last year at this time, isn't that nice? It's all there. Here we set. Now, it takes a telescope, and it takes mathematics to see if that's really just an illusion, not what it appears to be. Okay, but that was the idea. But you understand, it's theological. It's based on, in other words, they didn't base it on observation. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm saying you can look up and see it. But the conclusion was not based on observation. Observation seemed to bear out the conclusion, but the conclusion was theological. The earth must be the center of the universe because it's the abode of man, and man is the center of creation. That was the thing. That was considered orthodoxy. Now, Ptolemy's Almagest was it the Ptolemy. This is not the Ptolemy of the Book of Daniel. You know, about the days of not one of the kings of Egypt. This was the Ptolemy. It was the 2nd century Alexander, his Almagest was the standard textbook on astronomy used in the Middle Ages. Now, let me say this to you about Ptolemy's Almagest. While Ptolemy's Almagest did speak of a geocentric universe, what does that mean? What's a geocentric universe? Earth is the center of it, as opposed to a heliocentric universe, where the sun is the center of it, which is the axis. Not the center of the universe, center of our solar system. But often people will say this. Now listen, learn something here. Ptolemy's Almagest did not present this view. Y'all hear this. Well, in the medieval world, and some say in the biblical world, which isn't true, but certainly, let's say in the medieval world, if you see these diagrams and textbooks, that the world was something like, here was the earth, and here was the ocean, and here was the, here's where you fell off, if you sailed too far, and somebody didn't crush you up over there. And then here was the canopy, and there were holes in it, and that was the, and the sun and the stars were holes in the canopy, and heaven was just above this. You get up, so if you could theoretically get a ladder long enough, you get up to heaven. A very kind of a, you know, small, closed-in universe. It is true. But some people believe that, yeah. Some people draw pictures of that, yeah. But let me say, you see, the while Ptolemy's Almagest presented a geocentric world, cosmos, it is not true that medieval man, medieval thinkers, had that little tiny world, because as a matter of fact, as I say in the syllabus, Ptolemy's Almagest was the standard handbook on astronomy and religious. And Ptolemy, you read Ptolemy's Almagest, he says, for instance, that the earth is mathematically insignificant. That is, he knew, observed the fact, that the earth, while it was theologically significant, maybe, because Ptolemy was not a Christian, it was whatever purpose the gods had, it was mathematically insignificant. What does that mean? The universe is huge. The idea of the earth being simply one small, mathematically insignificant part of a huge universe is what Ptolemy held. He was right about that, wasn't he? The idea, and I say that because, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about this in his, one of his writings, I think, in college, which he says that all of a sudden modern man, by modern I mean like this century, have suddenly discovered that the size of the universe is an argument against God. Somehow, you know, because the universe is so big and the earth is mathematically insignificant, the earth mathematically, the earth is such a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the universe. All of a sudden that, and you see, somehow that came to be an argument against God, which is logically absurd. And his point is that back in the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, medieval period, when it was a theological world, they all knew how to be. The idea that it was modern man didn't discover, all of a sudden didn't say, oh, well, there can't be a God who created the universe. Why? Look how big it is. The earth is not the center of a small universe. The earth is a tiny part of a huge universe. Exit God. This is a non sequitur, doesn't follow. And the point here is that medieval man, who is very theological, knew nothing. They knew that it was not this tiny little cloak, that the earth was not a big part of a small universe. You understand that? Ptolemy said that the earth is not back in sin. They always knew that. And it's beyond reason that it was said that the size that they discovered that the earth is a small part of a large cosmos suddenly became an argument against God. And it is. Still used that way. You know, men could believe in a creator God as long as he thought that the universe was small and the earth was the big center of it. But now that we know that the earth is just a tiny, tiny, compared to mathematically insignificant planet around a minor sun in a minor solar system, constellation, which is one of millions of constellations, most of which are bigger, so much for God. As if, you know, you with me? This discovery of size suddenly became an argument against God. The point is they knew that. most of the textbooks, Western Civ textbooks, just picture the medieval view of the cosmos or something wrong. They're basing their conclusion that they read each other on this. And you know, everybody says that, that I can go ahead and skip next month to people. But what we all say must be true. I told you that. I have it. I'll take time this yogi when I'm thinking about this. Kipling's Mowgli stories. All the animals in the jungle, Ka, Python, Hoppy the elephant, the gear, the panther. None of them, they look at the monkey people. They hold them content. Monkey people think that they try to act like men. Okay, just stick all day, you can do great when you can build a house with it, and I'll get the phone. And then they're going to hit it and throw it away. They always talk about their life, too. They're always going to start fires and live in a house on the ground like men, but they never do it. They chatter all day, and they say, we're the wisest people in the jungle. The same for monkey people is, we are the wisest people in the jungle. We all say so, so it must be true. That's a lot of modern scholarship. Yeah. Must be true of why. Well, look, we all say so. And this is an example. Everybody says it. Must be true. That's evolution. Evolution is the cosmology of the monkey people. We all say it. Why? It must be true. Look how many of us there are. As if truth was established by one by the art of multiplication. It's not. One times five. You don't know how to think about this. 100,000 times zero is what?
Zero. That's the point.
You got zero, it doesn't matter how many times you multiply it. It's still zero. Anyway, back to my point. You get to see that you saw, you probably took a high school. I've seen the high school and you got your textbook. They have all that. This medieval world was tiny. Medieval cosmology was tiny, shut in. That's simply not true. Well, there's some who thought that way, yes. But all you gotta do is go look back at this that Tommy's Almagest, which was a standard handbook, this is what they all studied, they all quoted it and believed it. And that's not what you get at all. Okay, the government, y'all get that? As far as the position coincide with purpose and destiny, the hierarchy of reality corresponds to the physical universe. There's a hierarchy of position and purpose set forth by God. The governing laws were moral, not mechanical. The governing laws, got that, were moral, not mechanical. Why? Listen to me, it's not very strange to us. Why do the birds migrate? Why do the robins go south in the fall? The answer is because God has willed it. It's true. Therefore, they must do what is right. Right. Therefore, the governing laws were not mechanical. Now, Newton, we're going to see, comes along and changes all this. It's mechanical universe, cause and effect. But that they move, why do things act the way they do? They move at the behest of God under moral law. They went so far as, you know that the Roman Catholic Church has a liturgy for getting rid of flies? They used the Middle Ages to practice exorcise demons and flies and locusts. The locusts would come in on the Catholic Church, they would come in and try to exorcise them. Why? Because they are obviously being against God, destroying his people, Christian. It was a little extreme, and they would normally operate that way. But it's hard for us to think about that. Now, is there an element of truth in that? I think there may very well be. Right or wrong, that's how they thought. The governing law was moral. Okay, we'll take our break now, then we'll talk about the attitudes toward nature. I pray you all stick with me pretty well today. This is not easy. The world, as I said, was heaven's waiting room. It was a meaning other than a strictly religious meaning, not important in itself. Again, people would say that's going too far. The world was the realm of demons. See your simple sign.
I'm like, right, this is going on. Gerald, we're going to find you.
This was the first, I've got the first typing of it, and I think I've read it in the voice. I know I did it wrong. I'm sure I caught them all, that's why I say this. The world was the realm of demonic powers. Magic and sorcery prevailed rather than science. Persons were sick, he cast out a demon. Well, you mean make people sick, yes, sometimes. Does a type of person sick mean they've got a demon? No. A lot of superstition, and it was just that kind of world. You understand what that is. To some, the world was an overwhelming example of the sovereignty and majesty of God. A positive attitude that contributed indirectly to the rise of science, that is, if the world was rational, that rationality could be discovered by examining it. This came along later. If you look at the world and the mind of man, medieval thought was realistic. That is, it viewed the world to be real as perceived. The mind was capable of grasping the true essence of the world. It's realistic, first of all. That is, the world was what it appeared to be. Now, the evil mind. Now, is that a good or a bad way to operate in the flesh?
Most
of the time, it's good.
You call it common sense, realism?
Yeah. But that's how they do it. For instance, they believe in spontaneous generation. Why? Well, you put a bucket of water out under a tree, miles away from any body of water. When you come back a few weeks later, you get little tadpoles. Little keep your collar joints. That's obvious that water produced them. Why? There'll be the water and nothing else around. Oh yeah. And you can put feed sacks in a happy closed barn, open it up later, there'll be mice in there, obviously. Feed sacks produce mice. It's realistic that this is what it appeared to be. And which can get you in trouble. Because everything depends on your powers of observation and deduction. Things are almost what they seem. And that was the medieval mind. And the medieval mind saw the natural order as static. By that I mean, the medieval mind would say, the world is now precisely what God, as it was when God created. Static. That is, the trees that God created are the trees we see. All the different species and sub in various forms were considered to be created in their present form. That is, how many kinds of dogs do you have? They would have a house dog, they had a hunting dog. They didn't have as many kinds of dogs we have now, but they had different kinds of dogs. Why do we have those different kinds of dogs? The way God created them. He created all the canine species. Use modern terminology, just as they are. Got that? Everything is unchangeable. Therefore, everything is just the form that God created. The concept of evolution, certainly, or adaptation, anything else. There were six kinds of cows, and God created six kinds of cows. Genesis. Got that? So it was realistic and static.
How did they answer a question along that those lines? Some like no one used to plant like a or something.
But I did it this time.
Not even by accident.
Well, I was considered impious to try. We would be considered impious to try. to try to get new. Now they did. They did some. Yes.
What they see a new tree grow or something like that? Sorry.
They would say that kind of tree though was created by God, just as it is.
Oh, and not each individual.
No, not each individual tree, but every kind. Oh yeah. No, they didn't. You know, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mislead. They weren't saying that. You see a tree and God created it that way. You know, like, as they grew. Well, they're saying that every kind of tree.
Still had to be cases of accidental cross-pollination. Or
well, they did practice some things. For instance, they bred horses to get bigger horses. But that was simply a practice of eugenics. Consistently made the largest of the largest. They didn't see that was a new species. That was simply you had tall men and small men, and tall woman versus tall man and tall son, large horse,
bigger, large horse, get a large horse.
That is a new kind, just bigger, the same thing.
They didn't do any crafting or garden or anything like that.
No, there were no plant genetics. Now there would be some basic stuff based on observation. They would do things like they learned from experience, very simple things. But nothing that would be to be like eugenics.
So a tall man and a tall woman had a midget, that would be doing the game?
No. That would just be a not be to be interpreted as an act of God. But it certainly wasn't a new species of man. That's the thing.
Okay.
That's the point. There's no new species of man. That's a modern term, species. There's no new species or kinds of trees or plants or anything else. Basic form rather than created. It was realistic and static. It was just what it appeared to be. Now that's the medieval science saw the natural order as static, that is, with all its species created in their present forms. The only novelty could be providential acts of God. Nature was an unchanging organism. Unchanging organism. What were the sources of medieval thought? Reason and revelation, simple as that. Reason and natural theology, that is, if we are creations of God, we're here for His purpose, and for His heaven, then everything must go to that purpose. What is that? And revelation, which came through the church, which is called faith. That's what we're used for. We got that not in the Bible, the church. If you want to know the purpose of something, you don't examine it, you ask the priest. He knows why you know by revelation.
Listen, there's an element of truth in that.
Yes. But it's too limited. Look at God in medieval thought as it applies to this subject. This is not theology. According to Thomas Aquinas, God was a synthesis of the unmoved mover and the personal father. The unmoved mover and the personal father. By that, the uncaused causal, the uncaused source of causation. And again, I'll go a little farther than that. Now, they went too far. This unmoved mover was a part of the destiny. You know, Aquinas got that from Augustine. And he included in that. The doctrine of the unchanging God to the unchangeable God. And by that they meant that God could not be changed by human choice. The only truly free will in the universe is God. Therefore, God is the only efficient cause of anything. Everything man does is an effect. Why? Because God cannot be leave man free to change his will and act differently than he would have acted before, then God has to adapt himself to this new circumstance, and therefore God has to change. It's the basis of Calvinistic predestination. Philosophical final, the unchangeable God, which is therefore nature could not change, man could not change, or predestined one way or the other. Fixed. It's like this. It's like life is like, I'll use quote Shakespeare, life is like a life of the world is a stage and every man's a player. It's like that there was a divine script which nobody has been able to, has been allowed to see. Part of the church has part of it, but man is here following the script. What man does, what the world does, follows the script. It's all fixed.
Like a play.
Play fixed. What does the actor do? This persona in the play is trying to decide whether he's going to kill the beautiful young woman or not. And so he thinks about it. And either he does or he doesn't. But is it really a free choice? No. The script's all written ahead of time. Whether he kills the inmate pal or not, that depends upon what the scriptwriter put down. That's this concept of the unmoved mover. Calvin is a dude, by the way. Man is on the script. He might improvise a little bit along the way, but basically he has to follow the plot. Cannot escape the plot. The cosmological argument was used recently that the chain of cause and effect leads back to God. The first cause in Greek philosophy, God became the first cause. And again, I think we would agree with that, at least in part, would we not? The cause and effect goes back to God. Aquinas, God, was the continuing ruler of nature. That if anything is to happen, divine God must immediately agree to it. What I'm saying is, medieval man, governed by Aquinas, did not view nature as taking its course. And again, there's an element of truth in it. You need to be very careful in dismissing medieval thought. For instance, here, let me illustrate it this way. What happens when you have a bad summer thunderstorm that flattens the crops with a big dose of hail? That's in Georgia, South Georgia especially, when they read about tobacco, they won't. They have what they call a tobacco base. They can go so many acres. So they all put it, they don't have to be in one farm. The Spanish farm will spread it out. They'll throw it here, they learn that these hailstorms, a cloud will come through the hail in it. And then my flat partner problem. And farmer boys complains, okay, the question is, if a hailstorm comes through and does damage to your crops, the question is, why? Well, a modern meteorologist would talk about fronts and depressions and high pressure and low pressure, and the jet stream, and explain it through simple cause and effect, right? Simple cause and effect. Is that a sound science? It certainly is. Modern meteorologists can predict the weather, at least in broad terms, 4 or 5 days ahead of time. Why? Well, they can see what's forming up here. You can put it on the computer. The computer says, in these conditions, these are the probabilities. There's a 40% chance of rain, temperatures will be in this range. It's all projected. Why? Cause and effect. When you have this cause, this set of causes, 80% of the time you have this effect at this time of the year. Cause and effect. Is that valid? Sure, it's valid. But the medieval man would rule that out. Why did the hail destroy my wheat? Apparently I've sinned, and my wife has sinned, probably her. If I want to know why, I go to the priest with a confession, deal with God. Why? Because this could not have happened if God had not stepped in directly when it had happened. That is, God was the immediate cause of the weather, for example. I'm just going to use this as an example. And a theological reason was sought. Now, is that completely false? I've heard the Bible. That is, the point is, when you have examined the meteorological factors, have you dismissed God? Certainly haven't. But would you want to dismiss, would you go so far as to attribute every storm, destructive storm, as a judgment of God on your farm? No. Why? What the Bible teaches is that sometimes God uses the weather. I'm using against it. Now, we're talking about more weather. I'm just using an example. Sometimes God uses the weather to get a point across to man, right? But that's not every time it will change the weather, God's not trying to tell us something. But in the medieval mind, everything that happened was if we live right and pray enough, it'll rain. If we don't, it won't. So, y'all see that? So it was divine encouragement was required if anything was to happen. I think modern man's coming by the other way. You know, there could be some of these natural disasters. I wonder if God is not showing us how puny we are, we, modern secular man, is at the hearing. Well, anyway. What I'm teaching is that one is not good on the other. But medieval men would not consider meteorology. He had no basis for it. Now, they had a few basics. They would have sunrise at dawn in the morning, say, okay, morning. It's true. It's not just sunrise. Red sky in the morning, you say, okay, morning. Red sky at night, say, blood. It's true. But red sky in the morning, you use it. Marshall here, probably up front, coming your way. But beyond that, there's.
Okay. Well, I was looking at it philosophically. You could then go to take all the information that we'll ever know scientifically and still carry it over to the earth and say, but why did the flood come through? Or why was the tornado allowed or something?
Yeah. Because God can start the cause way back. And God can do these things. I don't dismiss God for natural disasters. I don't go so far as to interpret them as one, but I think we understand considerations. But there's a lot of Bible teaching. Well, why does Russia continue to have crop failures? They're some of the best farmland in the world. They have a short growing season, but they have about the same growing season as much as Russia or Canada has. Why? Is it just bad management? Is it the inefficiency of the socialist bureaucracy? Yeah, I think it's that. But beyond that, I wonder, is it just a coincidence that the nation that makes as a public policy thumbs its nose at God, the very idea of God, blaspheming systematically as a government policy, is a coincidence of that kind? Systematic, almost always has a crop failure, comes up short, people are hungry. Is it a coincidence? I'm not saying God is judging Soviet Russia, but I am saying it's certainly a possibility. He's been known to do that kind of thing before. Has he not? Certainly has. Why does America have such abundance? Is this simply good farming techniques? You look at the course of history, for instance. There's no reason in the world why the Allies should have won the Second World War. Abraham won. The critical time, because America came in too late, the critical time he simply won. All of a sudden turns stupid. He absolutely turns stupid. And would listen to his generals, listen to his astrologer, and shot himself in the foot. You know what I mean? And if the Allies could have won out of that way, they'd have a tough time with it. Why? Was it simply stupid? It's going too far. We've got a possibility of buying into the prayers of people in America.
I don't need it compared to its treatment at the same time as the depression of thirties, imagine what down in the 20s in America, decimal, the way nature's affecting America now. We're having a lot more floods at the end. We look historically back to flood, drought.
Yeah. Probably a combination of things. Well, all we're saying is that you're going too far to rule out. The medieval mind, here's a summary, you all already seen it, I'll just say it again. The medieval mind went too far in saying there was no natural cause of that. Everything was simply a divine intervention. Everything that happens direct act of God, particular reason. Everything that happens direct act of God, particular reason, that's going to be far. Because God did not operate that way. But it's going to be far the other way. Be a modern secular, a pure 100% secular, and say it's all natural causes that trace it all the way back to integrity. There's no divine element, whatever, that's going to go too far.
I think slightly off question, I can hear your response tonight. It seems that even though I made it down, I think I'll compare that movement. You know, a lot of them might say we were sick, well, they're terrible. And, you know, when you talk about the flood earthquakes, I hear, this isn't God. And this, they're asking a lot of people, you know, hey, this is the end times. This is your end.
Very medieval. Whereas poverty is when you're outside the will of God. Divorce, right? Healed marriage, just pray for it. Which is true. That kind of thing. Yes, very superstitious. Going too far the other way. Pat Robertson, maybe our next president, has turned hurricanes away from Virginia Beach or wherever he has done that. Did Jesus come to give us the same power over nature that he had? Is the question. No. But they would say yes. And the power of poverty. Yeah, that seems better. It's like the medium. Don't you get it?
Yeah.
You're right. Some way it's not your way. Well, but again, we need to go too far now and then become practicing secularism. I think we, as a general principle, as a general practice, I think we do not include God in that most of the time. I think we.
Any reaction?
Yeah, perhaps. It's a reaction. And we're sort of hoodwinked and brainwashed by the modern secular materialism. I think often we don't look for the divine element. We don't God either. Equation all my God. First, I'm of the opinion that God sends us messages all the time to be able to tune in. I see in my life, I've seen it in yours, I've seen other people's lives, a man or woman will be on a destructive path. They're gonna mess themselves up, get away from God. God will all kinds of roadblocks in the way. Chance to get off. Listen to the advice, the warnings. Question? Our purpose here is to see this medieval thought, and not to dismiss it as being absurd, but to see the limitations of it and the errors of it. God works. Continue on being God and evil law. God works in various ways to accomplish His will. Natural causes, the angels, they give us more attention to angels than we do. I think they give too much attention to angels. I think we can do more. The influence of the celestial bodies, God, astrology was a big thing, kind of sort of a pseudo Christian astrology in the Middle Ages, so that God used the stars. How His comets showed up, it was considered to be a it brought a plague, it was a judgment. And where to get the idea of, the moon causes madness, and what's a lunatic? Well, that's because it's a classical idea that never died out. Where did that come from? The full moon makes a man turn into a wolf. Other than that, it's you got that? A full moon, the evil. Evil comes to the surface. That goes back very old, but very ancient times. The medieval world had not got rid of that. So particle paganism, so that the celestial bodies affected you. Born under a lucky star.
You are not a lucky star.
And of course, miracles. And they saw miracles. Modern man is getting burned with evil. They saw miracles everywhere. The evil thought. They looked for them and saw them. And labeled things as such. Many of the shrines in the continent of Europe, now the Middle Ages, where miracles were supposed to happen, the Lady of Lourdes, and all kinds of realists saw miracles every time they were placed. They looked. And they were not. Man was the center of the universe. Nature was subordinate to man. Now, you had nothing of ecology, appreciation for the landscape. Nature was an enemy to be conquered. Man was to subordinate. If any animal threatening, man's job was to kill the animal off. The question became extinct and not ever occurred to him. Well, that's the reason, yes.
You know, like when they could extreme where like they look out at something, they would say, oh, let's just be your own friend or something like that.
Well, that's a good question. It never came out in their art or their literature. A tree, they appreciate the shade of a tree, yes, but tree was going to need to be cut down so they grow corn there. Just can't grow crop in the tree. Did they plant flowers? Yeah, some. But I think, Renee, that man being man thought that way, appreciated the beauty of nature, but it was very limited and suppressed to the extent that it just doesn't come out. Petrarch was supposed to be the first man to climb the mountain just about the same. He's one of about half a dozen to call the first modern man. And one of the areas that I studied in university was during the Renaissance period, was the Latin English. This is the first modern man, you know. If you can fill a room, the guys were nominated as the first modern man, but he's one of them for that reason. When Martin Luther came across the Alps, he didn't have to sing it. It was just a steep, miserable trip, you know, cold. They got over the better. You know, find landscapes and paintings. Nature was the enemy. To conquer the wilderness. Now keep in mind that they had to fight nature more than we did. One of the reasons that we today can be very friendly about nature. We embrace the solicitous of the good of nature, and we should be. One thing we were probably the strongest in the I think man has a debt of stewardship. I think we have a theological focus for it. I think ecology has a theological base. We have a stewardship of the world. But you see, that's because we can control it now. The machines, there's many of us, has been conquered. You can heal the mother's wild. We have a summer energy. So we can obliterate nature now quite easily. You go into what was once a forest, and two men on big tractors can destroy 10 acres of forest and go. You realize how many men it would take. But say that was your farm medieval period. You couldn't stay ahead of the horse. And get you. Get credit by hand, carry four tools, broke easily. And it was a real job just to keep the woods out of your brush and take it over your field every year. You know what I'm saying? And nature, and the hills were steep and the air was cold, the sun was hot, which is a tree in love. And the bugs and get you. Eat you out there 2 or 3 years out of 5. And see what I'm saying? So nature was beautiful as and was more threatening than it is now. But man was nature was to be supportive of man and nature and man's job. See the medieval period also, you see, much of hundreds and hundreds of millions of acres that had been under till in the classical period went back to the woods and wolves. The destruction of Rome, the disintegration of Rome, all of France, Italy, Russia, Germany, Germany, England. Well, there once had been cities of some considerable size, but the medieval period, there's the movies. Wild animals to the world. So it was a different look view than we do. You can see why they do not. So nature was subordinate to man. Now, and nature is subordinate to man, but that person they had side of people. Nature primarily was seen as the stage of the drama of God and man. It's not important in itself. Nature's kind of, go back to my analogy of the stage. Now, nature was the props on the stage. Props were there for the drama. After the play's over, you throw them away, stack them away. They weren't important in and of themselves. And nature was, this is the natural world, was that. It's the battle between good and evil, God and Satan. Man has to choose sides, play out the drama, win the battle if you can. And nature was just something of the stage on which this was carried out. And again, is there an element of truth in that? Yes, there is. But it's too limited. Nature is that, but it's much more than that. And you know, for instance, I went through this. I grew up in a farm, plants. I spent my early middle period on tractor. I thought I was part of a tractor. And planting. And then I went through a period of life when I didn't have too busy to do anything else, but I didn't care much for plants. I'm back to pretty everything to get global, but I get a great lot. I never thought I'd get out of planting things once to grow. I had a very small lot, and my wife was always trying to dig up stuff because I put too much in. But now I don't have the money to do it right, and I don't have the time. But I just get a real delight out of planting something in the spring. Trimming it a bit and spreading a couple of times and lots of money. And why? It's because I'm the image of God. The first things God did on earth was plant a garden. I think we're being like God in that we do the thing for itself. You see, nature for itself. Why do you think there are flowers? Why are flowers so pretty? And God. All they do, is it necessary? No, all kinds of flowering roses. Why are three birds and insects so beautiful, animals so beautiful? Why? Because God is that kind of God, and man is the image of God. So that man has, what I'm trying to say is that man has a field where nature that is beyond the simple utilitarian requirement of props for a stage. That is, do you enjoy doing that? No. Especially you have time to think about it now, but now I like to cut out the landscape and mow the grass and see it green and put in some flowers and watch it grow. Why? Does it serve any useful purpose? Not really. Not really. You know, does it have anything to do with the battle between good and evil? No. I'll fight that by, you know. I'll go on television, fight abortion, whatever. I'll fight that battle as best I can. But I have a relationship with nature, at least in medical sense. But I can't explain it in utilitarian terms or theological terms in the sense of battle, good versus evil. It's not direct. See what I'm saying? So nature seems to have, and we were this way. Not just name the landscape. It's natural for man to try to bring order out of chaos. Understand? Such a good feeling, putting order out of chaos. Why do we landscape the building, mow the grass, plant trees? Could we have a colony without them? Sure. Is it simply what the neighbors would say? No. That's not that. Why? There's something in man that wants to have a kind of an organism to have it look pretty. As opposed to the weeds grow. Now, in the medieval world, weeds grew. It had lawns. Do you ever notice the old houses, the old towns are up against the sidewalk? Lawns, why couldn't it? Hard and expensive to take care of anyway. But now, all I'm saying is that man, since that man sees, has a relationship with nature, he interacts with nature, he deals with nature, he sees nature as being beautiful and significant in and of itself. At least to him, in and of itself. Thing for the sake of itself. Frankly, a beautiful flower exists for the sake of itself. Not just to get nectar from the bees, or to conversate, or to come on heaven, just there.
It seems like that this life plays maybe a more of a role in men's attitude, because while we are walking to a neighborhood, it's all up down with people's attitudes that are up there. And but when you take an effort, it may not be immediately, but it looks like to grow a garden or something. But when you take pride in something, then the whole, you know, all your attitudes.
And there's a direct relationship to spirituality, although many exceptions there are definite tendencies. That is, people who are godly tend to seek beauty of nature. People who are ungodly tend not to. Not many exceptions. And people who are morally decrepit tend to, I don't know, or I don't care. Now, that's the worst simplification, but I'm saying people change the tendencies. And sometimes they can, you know, I realize that, but
I can't stand that.
We wouldn't do that.
No, see, I grew up where, you know, the grass was chained up and a tree for it to stay there had to have a plastic chain on it and cemented into the side of it. So,
you weren't raised that thing with that, but that way. But yes, kid, you paint your house? Keep it nice?
Well, the inside.
Yeah.
The outside. Land, that's
right. Yeah. Well, it's not your house, but you see what the man tends to beautify things. We paint our walls and we pick up the garbage. Why? I'm simply saying that man, there is something in man that sees nature as something besides something to be trumped on and used for a purpose beyond it. Not that we don't look beyond the natural world, which we do. And for the same reason that God, in other words, let me just tell you. Well, it is true that God created a world that works and created. We live in a teleological cosmos. It is also, while that is true, it is also true that our world is unnecessarily beautiful. It's unnecessarily beautiful and varied.
Isn't something else here? Isn't that the term beauty in the eye of the beholder in order to? And we're supposed to enjoy the flowers. We're supposed to enjoy.
No, I think it wasn't learned behavior.
You think things. You couldn't have been that we could have all been shaped differently. Or the ideal man and the mountains of the stomach and all those things that are supposed to be, you know, that would make so much more sense.
Well, you can't.
And not have.
No, you can't.
I guess you're going back too far. But.
No, you can't. That's the old argument that this is the best of all possible worlds. Anyway, my point is, I don't mean to go too far astray, that nature is more than the stage for the drama of God and man. And I think I'm trying to say is that man in general senses this. And that as man becomes more like God, then there is this appreciation for it. Oh, such things. The whole area is the area of aesthetics. Beauty existing for its own sake, in whatever form it is, music. I think one of the greatest evidences for God is the human ability. It's totally evolutionarily speaking, it's totally unnecessary. Like that was music that is. Do you enjoy that music? No. You have to have it, you know. Expensive pictures. But you see, why do we sing? We go to the name of God. God didn't put a swan, but God didn't have to make that pretty word. wants to make a plea. Well, nature, the world history, this is helpful, I think. World history was summarized, or could have been summarized, in five words in medieval thought. Creation, covenant, Christ, church, consummation. There was creation, there was a covenant, the Old Testament, there was Christ, there's the church, there's the consummation, and that's it. That's history. All world history could be summarized under those five headings. In that progression, that's how they talk. The focal point of the whole thing is redemption. God is to be saved from this world. So no more truth than that, so it is. But man is to do, are we to do nothing here but see to it that we escape hell? No, we're to do much more. Man is a union of mortal body and immortal soul in the Greek sense, in the medieval view. Man is a free and rational being against the Greek view, although they contradicted this with their theology very often. Understand theology is a contradiction. And human existence as a pilgrimage. Is human existence a pilgrimage? Yes. Is it only a pilgrimage? Well, no. This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. True? True. Does that mean that this world then essentially does not count? No. So one of the things that medieval theology did was they put salvation in the future tense of all times. Salvation in biblical theology and salvation in the present tense. That is, we begin the relationship now. In the medieval sense, death was from the second work of grace. It didn't work that way. But that is, an evil man is very evil, very corrupt, ignorant, dirty, crude, obscene. And people figuratively die, all the change. Death was from the grave, in the future. And this passing through our ability. They get to understand that one of the reasons why it's easier for us to think beyond the simple pilgrimage concept is that we live longer. In those days, if you lived to be 35, you'd be gods. We're going to be old people around. The average teenager, the average age of the man on the crusade is a teenager. That would be personal when you're a teenager. Your childhood was over when you're 14. Started, you know, having children. You know, responsibilities. So life is very short. It's easier to think about the pilgrimage. It's very short. Okay. Well, we come now to the effect of the Protestant Reformation. This is a very important point. The medieval worldview was not substantially altered by the Reformation. The Protestant Reformation changed almost nothing in this regard. Very little. That is, man, the role of man, the role of nature, essentially the same. It was changed not. It was not Martin Luther and John Calvin and Karl Stadt or Bucher who changed that. It was Galileo and him. That's not the point. Started a new section, got it all 86, we went out into those stars. I'm going to start some